We're looking at this parable in Matthew 20, verses 1-16, the parable of the labourers. We could call it the parable of the generous landowner. So Matthew 20, verses 1-16. Every year, in one of the jobs I used to do, there was a bit of a tradition on Christmas Eve. And the way it worked was a bit like this. In the run-up to Christmas Eve, the manager of our department would be saying, "No one gets to go home early on Christmas Eve. Everyone's got to work just a normal day's work." And then on Christmas Eve, you'd get to about 1 o'clock and the manager would say, "Right, everyone can go home." And it would happen like that every year, apart from one year when it didn't happen. And that was annoying because everyone expected it to happen. Now, I was always, obviously, you know, everyone's happy, you get to go home early. But part of me also felt it was a bit unfair in how this manager did it. Because I'd go into work pretty early, I'd be starting work really early in the morning. Other people, you know, would just rock up at, you know, nearly 10 o'clock, and then they'd work later, obviously. But you know, they turn up at 10 o'clock, and then we all get to go home at the same time. Well, I like my manager's generosity, but then I just didn't like the way she used to implement it sometimes. Silly, isn't it? Because we all got to go home early. We all benefited from it. Now, sometimes, to our shame, we don't like God's grace when it's not applied the way we think it should be applied. And that's what Jesus is teaching in this parable. But to see that, to see what's happening in this parable, we've got to spend a few minutes going through a bit of a sweep of the previous couple of chapters. I think it will be helpful for us to do that. So that's the first thing we're going to do. We're going to look at the context itself. So to go back to chapter 18 and verse 1, if you've got a Bible in front of you, it's worth just looking at these verses. I pick them out. Chapter 18, verse 1, the disciples have come to Jesus and they've asked this question: who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? That's what they're interested in. Now, asking that question isn't simply, how do I become great? It's, how do I become greater than other people? Am I greater than him over there? Where am I in the pecking order? Am I higher? Am I lower? And if I'm lower, how do I climb above them? This is a relative thing. Who is greater than whom in God's kingdom? I think the disciples must think they're pretty near the top. It's the sort of question that you only really ask if you're hoping for a certain type of answer. But in chapter 18, verse 4, Jesus' response is, look, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. We looked at these verses when we were looking at the parable of the lost sheep in verses 12 onwards of chapter 18. He's talking about a child there because children in those days were seen as unimportant, you know, to be seen but not heard, unimpressive, they had no rights, they had no status. Jesus saying, seeing ourselves like that is what leads to greatness in the kingdom of heaven. Now last week we were still in chapter 18, we looked at verse 21 onwards in the parable there. So chapter 18, verse 21, Peter comes up to Jesus and says, look, how many times should I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Now again, notice the emphasis for Peter here. He's not thinking about how many times he's going to sin against his brother and need to be forgiven. He's not thinking about how many times he's going to sin against God. He's the one who's going to be doing the forgiving here, and he wants to know how generous he should be. And Jesus says, not just seven times, but 70 times seven. Again, Peter sees himself as a bit of a somebody, the person who's going to be doing the forgiving. And Jesus then tells that parable, still in chapter 18, verse 22 to the end of the chapter, a parable about an unforgiving servant. And the lesson for the disciples is they are to forgive much because they have been forgiven much. That it's having a right view of ourselves and the huge debt we had towards God then gives us the right perspective to forgive other people's much lesser debts against us. But the disciples don't learn very quickly. They're a lot like us, aren't they? We need to keep hearing the same lessons again and again because we're very slow. And that's what the disciples are like. they you'd think they'd learn their lessons here, but they don't. Because you look at where we started reading in chapter 19, verse 13, little children are being brought to Jesus, and you'd think surely they'd learn what Jesus thinks about children by now, that he welcomes them, that he loves children, that he says you need to become like a child. But no, when children come to Jesus, chapter 19, verse 13, the disciples rebuke them. Get away from Jesus. Why are they doing it? Well, presumably they think, well, these children aren't important enough. They're not significant enough to take up any of Jesus' time. Jesus should be spending time with more significant people. People like us, I guess they think. These children don't have very much to offer Jesus. They're not great. And so in verse 14, Jesus has to rebuke them and say, "Let the little children come to me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." Now then you've got this account of the rich young ruler, verses 16 to 26, still in chapter 19. He comes to Jesus. He claims to have this great morality. He says, "I followed all the Ten Commandments. In fact, in verse 20, I've kept them all from my youth." Jesus says, "If you want to be perfect, go and sell your possessions, and then you'll find treasure in heaven." But this man won't do it, so he goes away very sad. Now, what I want you to notice is the response of the disciples in verse 25. When they hear about Jesus saying how hard it is for a rich man to go into the kingdom of heaven, the disciples were astonished. And they say, "Well, who then can be saved?" Why are they asking that question? Well, because surely they must think, well, if a man like that can't be saved, what chance does anyone have? They think this rich young ruler is first in the pecking order. He's rich, he's a ruler, he's got great morality, he's kept all the Ten Commandments since his youth, or at least so he says. If he can't go to heaven, if he can't be saved, well, who can be saved? You see how skewed their thinking has become. They see it as this sort of pecking order, and people like that rich young ruler at the top, maybe people like these disciples are up there close by in some way, but children are down there at the bottom. They haven't quite got what Jesus is teaching here. They still think greatness is all about status and power and influence and education and even morality, following all the rules. We carry on in chapter 19 and verse 27. Peter asks this question. He says to Jesus, "Look, we have left all and followed you. Therefore, what shall we have?" And what's he interested in here? Now, you could take different approaches to this, but I would argue here, he is asking, "What reward do I get for the great sacrifices I've made for you, Jesus?" In fact, not just Peter, he says, we've all of us, 12 disciples, we've left everything behind. So what do we get? And the reason I think Peter's question is not of good motive, not entirely sincere, is because of the way Jesus responds to him. In verse 28, Jesus says, "Yes, there will be a reward. There will be a great blessing for you. You who have followed me will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." That's a reward for those 12 disciples, something just for them. They're going to have a special place in heaven where they sit on these thrones and rule. But then, verse 29-30, Jesus stops talking about those 12 disciples, and there's something of a rebuke for them, because he says, "And everyone who has left houses, brothers, sisters, father, mother, lands, and so on, will receive 100-fold and inherit eternal life." And so he was saying that you're not unique here, you 12, Peter. You've not done something special here. You think you've done something unique in leaving everything to follow me. Actually, everyone who follows me is leaving things behind. Peter, you're not as great as you think you are. And then he says, Peter, verse 30, "Many who are first will be last, and the last first. I think that sentence is something of a summary of what Jesus has been driving home again and again in slightly different ways with the children, with the rich young ruler, with the conversations he's having with the disciples. Those who in this world, those who people see in this world as being last, as they come to Jesus as children, will be first in that kingdom. And the danger for Peter and the disciples here is that they've got such a skewed perspective of everything. They're so obsessed with their own greatness, with what reward they're going to get, that yes, they'll be in the kingdom, but they won't be first. And the very people they're looking down on, like those children that came to Jesus, may well actually be at the front of the queue. Well, we thought a little bit about the context, and I think that's worth doing before we look at the parable itself. Let's look at the parable itself now. That's the second thing we're going to do. We're going to look at the parable itself. Because the parable Jesus tells in chapter 20 teaches that lesson he's just given to Peter, where he says, many who are first will be last, and the last first. And you can tell that because that's how he sums it up. That's the moral of the story in chapter 20, verse 16. So it's this story about a landowner who goes out to hire workers in his vineyard. He heads down to the marketplace early in the morning, presumably 6 a.m, and he finds some workers. He agrees to pay them one denarius each for a full day's work, which is a fair amount to pay. It's a reasonable wage for a day's work. Verse 3, he goes out again at the third hour, 9 a.m, recruits more workers. And this time he doesn't agree a particular wage, he just says, he'll be fair to them. I'll give you a fair wage for the work you do. He does the same thing again at the sixth hour, midday. The same thing again at the ninth hour, 3 p.m. And the same thing again at the 11th hour, 5 p.m. before the day's work finishes at 6 o'clock. This, by the way, is where we get our phrase about talking about the 11th hour from. It's from here, late in the day. Now, in verse 8, they're all given their wages. And we're specifically told that the owner pays those who were employed last first, and that then he pays those who were employed first at the very end. Now, even that little detail, I think, goes a little bit against the grain. It sort of grates with us a little bit, doesn't it? That those who have put in a long shift have to hang around and watch everyone else getting paid, just have to sit there waiting even longer. Shouldn't they get to go home first, after all the work they've done? Well, they stay there, and those who worked for 1 hour, at the end of the day, they get one denarius. So you can sort of, that thought naturally flashes through the mind of people who've been there all day, doesn't it? I put in a grueling 12-hour shift. The master's obviously in a generous mood. He's been very generous in paying a denarius for 1 hour's work. What am I going to get? We're in line for a good bonus here. But it doesn't happen. He just gives them one denarius each. Now, you've got to bear in mind that it was the landowner who went out to the market and found these workers. They had no work. They probably would have sat hanging around the marketplace all day with nothing to do, but he's kind, he's generous, he goes out, he offers them a fair wage, he doesn't abuse them, he doesn't pay them, you know, peanuts for a whole day's work. He's fair, he's generous. But then when he gives them that generous wage, when he pays them the denarius he's promised them, they start complaining and grumbling, all because he's chosen to be generous to other people. And they've completely forgotten about his generosity to them. All that he's done, he's just given them a day's work and paid them fairly for it. But there's no gratitude. There's no thankfulness from them. Instead, they're complaining and grumbling. And I think there's a little phrase in verse 12 that's the key about what their complaint is, where they say, you made them equal to us. You know, we've slogged our guts out all day in the heat of the midday sun, and then they just come along and do the easy shift, mess around for an hour, do a bit of work, and they get the same. You've made them the same as us. That's not fair, is it? So the response comes then in verses 13 to 15. What? why are you accusing me of doing something wrong? I've paid you your wages, I've been fair, I've been generous. In verse 15 he says, look, isn't it up to me to do what I choose with my money? And then he asks him a question, verse 15. Or is your eye evil because I am good? He says their eye is evil. In other words, their eyes have been distracted by what they were given, and they're looking at what someone else has been given. Their eyes being turned away by that. But actually it's been turned away to think that way, he says, because I am good. Because the landowner is being generous. They're angry because they've not been treated better, in their opinion, than other people are. They don't like his generosity to those people over there. I'm worthy of generosity, but they're not. You know, if he'd have chosen to pay those people who'd worked 1 hour, one denarius, but then if he'd paid them 10 denariuses for a 12-hour shift, that would have been okay, wouldn't it? Yep, it's okay for him to be generous to me. It's just not okay for him to be generous to them over there. So Jesus' conclusion is, so the last will be first, and the first last. Those who think they are most deserving of God's generosity will actually end up at the back of the queue. And those who expected to be right at the front will actually be right at the very end. Well, we've talked about the context, we've talked about the parable itself, and then there are two lessons that come out of this parable for us now, and the second lesson will build on the first one. So here's the first lesson for us. We misunderstand God's grace when we think we deserve it. We've got these workers who have put in this 12-hour shift, and they think they're the type of people who deserve generosity. But those other workers, they're not. Remember, Jesus is still teaching his disciples about themselves, about how the disciples have just completely misunderstood something so essential to what the kingdom of heaven is all about. He's still dealing with that question back in chapter 18. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He's still dealing with Peter, who's just said, look at how much I've left. What do I get out of this? Because they still don't understand God's grace, his generosity. We believe we're saved by grace. We've sung some hymns about that this morning. We read it in Ephesians right back at the beginning of the service, how we're saved by grace through faith, that it's not of ourselves, it's a gift from God. It is a gift. But then what we can start to do is, I suppose, what these disciples are doing here in just forgetting about it in the day-to-day implications of our lives. I think for Peter, we said it was the sacrifices he was making. I'm sure I'm in line for something good now after everything I've given up. And you know, he has given what's up to follow Jesus. Sometimes as parents, we come across this tension. You know, every year, we give your children Christmas presents. And as a parent, I want to be generous with my children. I want to give them good presents they can enjoy. But they're presents. Now imagine if one year there were no presents under the tree. The tree was just empty. I think if many children had that, what would they say? They'd turn around to their parents and say, that's not fair. We always get presents. And if someone were to say that, if a child were to say that on Christmas Day, you see what they've done. They've turned a gift into a right, into something they deserve. I think what could even push it even further is if they said, but I've been really good all year. As if to say, I've earned those good presents. And when they do that, they've missed the point. You can't earn presents. If you can earn them, they're wages. They're not gifts anymore. We don't give our children presents because they've earned them, because they've been good. We give them presents because we love them, because we want to give good gifts to them. We want to see their faces as they open them. We want them to enjoy them. See, we're in danger if if, like Peter, we look at our sacrifices we make for the kingdom like that. And the danger is subtle, because making sacrifices for Jesus is a good thing to do. We start thinking, yeah, I am really tired, but I'll push through and I'll go to the prayer meeting tonight. I'll do it. I'll make the sacrifice. And I'm sure there'll be something for me, won't there? Yeah, I don't want to go down and clean the church. I'd really rather not do it, but then you make yourself go and do it. And as you're walking round, there's a sense of, yeah, I'm a bit of a hero here. It's a sunny day. Here I am cleaning inside the church. Everyone else is outside enjoying the sunshine, but look at me. Yeah, I'll go, I'll care for my mum or dad while they're sick. It's very inconvenient. I've got a lot else on in my life, but I'll do it. Now, what's difficult here is those are good things to do. Please don't take from this, oh, I better stop doing it, or if my motive isn't pure. No, do them even if you struggle with your motive for doing things sometimes. We still do the right thing. It's better to do the right thing from the wrong motive than to not do the right thing at all. These are good things to do. But the danger comes when we think we're building up points with God and we think at some point we get to cash them in. I think that's what Peter thinks here. Look at all these things I've done. How do I get to cash in my chips with you? We start thinking, yeah, God will repay me for this. Because then we've forgotten God's grace. We're not motivated by that anymore. You could look at that rich young ruler, and one of the features of him was his morality. He says, I've kept all these commands since my youth. Now, we could debate whether he really has kept them in his heart or not. He won't have done, but externally, at least on the outside, on the surface, he's a very moral person. He's done very well. He's tried really hard. He's got good morality. Yeah, for someone like him, you could be thinking, well, surely I've earned the right to go to heaven. It's, you know, someone like me. Grace means remembering we enter God's kingdom completely undeserving, as sinners who need to be forgiven. And grace then means we live in God's kingdom, yet undeserving of God's gifts, but receiving them again and again and again. That's how we receive God's blessings in our lives. Not from earning them, but because he loves us. He's a father who loves to shower liberally good gifts into the lives of his children. Well, the second lesson for us, I said it builds on the first, it says, we misunderstand God's grace when we think we deserve it more than others. This isn't just a parable about how grace is undeserved. It is that, but it's more than that, because remember, the disciples are comparing themselves to others. They're ranking themselves in the pecking order, where these children are down at the bottom. They've got this skewed view of how you get to the top and be the greatest. Even with those sacrifices, I think the implication of Peter is, look how much I've sacrificed. Look how well I'm doing. I'm going to get a greater reward, surely. What about us? We have particular ideas about who is most worthy of receiving God's grace. Because actually, to even think that way means we're forgetting the very definition of grace. The answer is, no one's worthy of God's grace. We can think to ourselves, well, I've attended more prayer meetings than some other people. I'm on plenty of rotas. I'm pretty good at that. I'm good at giving, but I reckon so-and-so. I'm not sure they give anything at all. I'm pretty good at giving myself, though. Now, again, those are good things to do. Those are right things. They honour the Lord when we do those things. But what our Lord Jesus is warning against is when we start thinking those things put us at the front of the queue, those things guarantee us more blessings than other people, or even, in fact, the other way around, those people shouldn't receive blessings because they don't do some of the things that I do. Sometimes what can lead us to think that way is that we can have an inflated sense of importance of ourselves and the things we do and the way we think and the things that I'm clear on in my own mind. Got work that we do. And the things I do, they're the most valuable. The things I understand about the Bible, I'm really clear on that. I've got that sorted out. She doesn't get that at all, but I do. Think about it in terms of the service, the work that we do for the Lord. You think of a young man I know who was just desperate to preach for years. I talked to him about this, and he was desperate to be at the front preaching, teaching, leading Bible studies. But he wasn't willing to get stuck in and help at the kids' club, even though he could have. He wasn't willing to mow the grass outside church, or wash the communion glasses, or clean the toilets. Well, that's for other people, isn't it? And I can only really conclude he saw himself as one of the first. There's particular jobs I'm willing to do, and they're not for me. Other lesser people should do those sorts of things. It was wrong. And I think of a man as well, who, in our church in Cardiff, we would turn up to church, a few minutes before 11 o'clock, and regularly he would have been there for some time, outside the front of the church, with a dustpan and brush, gloves on, a bin bag, and he'd be down picking up all the broken glass, all the beer bottles that had been smashed by all the youths who would hang around by the church, all the crisp packets, all the rubbish that just got blown by the wind into the porch area by the front of the church. I doubt very much he enjoyed it. I doubt very much he saw it as his calling, something he loved to do. He never made a show of it. He didn't complain at everyone else as everyone else just walked past and headed on into the building. But he did it because he cared about the Lord. He cared about how the church looked in the community. He wanted to do what he could to serve his Saviour. What do we think when we see someone like that? Well, I know what I think of him now when I compare him against this parable. Think of Jesus' words, the last will be first, and the first will be last. And I think to myself, was I too great? Was I too busy in my own thinking to get down on my hands and knees and pick up broken glass with him? Especially as those youths are all riding past on their bikes and they can see what we're doing. Was I too great in my own eyes to join him with that? Jesus' definition of greatness is just so different to ours. He says if we want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, if we want to be first, then we go about making ourselves last. One way we do that is just by acknowledging that everything we receive is by grace. Again, this parable is about comparing ourselves to other people. And we do that so quickly. We can be happy, like we were saying to the children, happy with what we've got until we see what the Lord's given someone else. God's blessed him with such a lovely house, and I wish I had somewhere to live like that. And he doesn't even seem to appreciate it. And look at her and all the blessings she's got in her life. And yet she doesn't do as much for God as I do. Everything seems to be rosy in her life, though. And surely I should be getting those things. And Jesus says, hang on, God is sovereign. And in his sovereignty, he's good to every one of his children. Can't he give good gifts and different gifts to each one of them? Aren't they all his to give as he pleases? Why are we so slow to rejoice when we see God's grace in other people's lives? We're so quick to rejoice when we get something we wanted. Why are we so slow? Well, I mean, of course they don't deserve those gifts. Is that part of it? We can see other people and think that they don't deserve that. And in a sense, that is true. They don't deserve it. But have we lost sight of the fact that we don't deserve it either? We'll summarise by saying what John the Baptist says. John the Baptist in John chapter 3, he's talking about Jesus. He says, "He must increase, but I must decrease. In my thinking, he must become greater and I must become less. The bigger my view of Jesus is and what he did on the cross for me, the smaller I become in my own thinking. The more clearly I see that wonderful act of grace of Jesus at the cross, the less I will think of myself and my little achievements. The more I see God's grace being poured into my life undeservedly every day. The more I count my blessings and see them as blessings rather than wages, the quicker I will be to put others first in my thinking, in my actions. As we do that, we're never going to miss out, because we have a generous God, a God who loves us, a God who loves to give to his children. You know, no one who trusts him is ever going to be empty-handed. Everyone who trusts in Christ, our hands are full. We have a generous God as we give thanks to him for his grace. Let's close and sing. Number 504, it's a hymn about God's sovereign grace. And the final hymn says, "Say while lost in holy wonder, why, O Lord, such love to me? Hallelujah, grace shall reign eternally." We'll stand and sing 504.